Welcome, everybody. Thanks for coming. We are excited to have Austin Clements here with us today. He is currently a managing partner at OPV, and that is an early stage venture fund that is focused on technologies that help small businesses. He was previously at 10110, where our co-organizer Minnie is now. Yay, 10110. And he is also the chair of Pledge LA, which is a coalition of VC firms that was brought together by the Annenberg Foundation and Mayor Garcetti. So please welcome Austin Clements to the stage.
Hello, everyone. Thank you so much for coming out. Thank you to the Friday. I mean, this meetup group is just awesome. So thank you guys for even having me. I really appreciate it. I'm going to talk today about giving an inside look at VC firms. I know a lot of times for entrepreneurs, VC seems so obscure. You don't understand why VCs make the decisions that they do or take the actions that they do. I think it's good to start from the foundation. What I want to say about this is I do want this to be interactive. If we get through five slides and no one asks a question, then I know that I've lost everybody. So please pop your hand up as soon as you have a question. I wholly expect, and we'll get the microphone to you very quickly. I know usually we do Q&A at the end, and this I hope to do it throughout. So please ask questions when you have them. So for the agenda, just really quickly what I'm going to go through. Venture capital firm structure, tell you exactly how venture capital firms are put together, which gives you insight into the rest of the presentation. How VCs evaluate companies, how you find the right, finding the right investors, and then standing out from the crowd. So how do you get investors to go through with you? I have a bunch of slides. We'll see how much we could get through, and again, please ask questions because that's what's going to make this the most interesting. For context, I want to give a little background of my background. I start out, I ran a dev shop doing web and mobile development for a lot of small business. This is places like it would probably be like an app like for cross campus or for a restaurant or law firm or something like that. And then I did that for years, and then I transitioned into venture capital. I work for 10110 Ventures alongside many. By the way, 10110 Ventures has an awesome podcast. So if you haven't if you want to learn more about the LA venture ecosystem, definitely check out LA Ventures, the name of the podcast. And then recently I started OPV, which is a venture firm that's focused specifically on tools that support the development of small business. So think things like, I guess out here in LA, we have Service Titan, other companies like, Square or Gusto or Xero or things like that, that target small business as their primary customer. So that provides a little context. I've been in venture for the last 5 years. So let's hop into it though. How are venture firms structured? Here are the basic mechanics of venture firms. So first I want to make the distinction between angel investors and VCs. So angel investors are investors that actually invest their own money, right? So this means that their own personal money they're putting toward your company. They believe in it, they like you, and they want to get behind it. VCs, on the other hand, VCs are professional money managers. We manage other people's capital. That is, by definition, what a venture capitalist is. We invest in early stage companies, but we're investing other people's money. We do have a portion of we invest in the fund as well, a small portion, but for the most part, the bulk of the capital comes from other people. It's actually structured as a partnership between the fund manager, which is also called the general partner, and the person whose actual cash this belongs to, which could be an endowment, it could be for a school, it could be a foundation endowment, it could be a pension fund, or it could be just someone else who's high net worth. They all commit capital to our fund, and they act as limited partners. We as fund managers are the general partners. So if you hear me refer to GP, that's the general partner, that's the fund manager. If you hear me refer to LP, that's the person whose cash it actually belongs to. this is where I said, boom, okay, two questions. There we go. I can repeat the question. Yeah. Sure. Great question. Oh, the angel, he asked me to describe the angel landscape in Los Angeles. So I think that Los Angeles does not have as robust a angel network as, say, Silicon Valley, in terms of people that identify themselves as angels and are actively making investments. However, from an absolute number standpoint, I would argue that we do have more angel investors than Silicon Valley. But they just usually don't call themselves angel investors. Usually what they are executives at companies that are related to the industry that you're in. You come and talk to them and say, hey, you know, you run a media business. And so you talk to somebody that's at NBC Universal, that's an executive that wants to understand what kind of technologies or companies are on the emerging horizon. And they have the capital to deploy a little bit of capital to help you out or to get behind you. And they just want to be a part of something. So they make an angel investment. That executive at NBC Universal would never call themselves, hey, I'm an active angel investor. So that's how I view the landscape in Los Angeles. They're out there, but don't think about it. Don't search LinkedIn for Los Angeles angel investor. You're not going to find anybody. Was there another question really quickly? Sure. Okay, so angel syndicates are often on like AngelList platforms, like AngelList, where it's people that come together, and if you list yourself on AngelList or you want to do a deal, and somebody basically pools capital, almost like a mini fund, but it's pooling capital to deploy into your fund. So usually somebody will approach you and they'll say, "Hey, you know, I run an AngelList syndicate. I want to invest into your company. I'll set up a syndicate, and I have 20 friends that all invest alongside me, and their friends have the option of whether they want to or not. Different from a fund, whereas as a fund, like if we have a $50 million fund, for example, all of those commitments were made up front, and then the fund manager, me as the GP, I decide where that money is allocated. With the angel syndicate, basically you decide, each angel decides on a deal by deal basis whether they want to invest or participate in the round or not. All right, I'm going to go hop on to the next thing. So the one thing that you really want to know about VC and venture that helps understand all the incentives and all the motivations is how VCs get paid. GPs charge 2 and 20 to LPs. Raise your hand if you've heard the phrase 2 and 20 in the context of venture or anything else. Okay, awesome. So 2 and 20, that's a phrase that you'll hear in financial services, generally in hedge funds, private equity funds, things like that. What that means is we charge 2% of the assets under management every year. So again, if I have a $50 million fund, I charge I collectively charge them 2%, which is $1 million. And what that will do is help me with my operating budget for paying salaries of myself and my partners and my associates, also paying for office space and like the basic operational activities of the fund. So that keeps the lights on. 2% keeps the lights on. 20% or 20 means I also charge 20% of the profits. So if I have a $50 million fund, I got $50 million worth of commitments. What I'd like to do as a fund manager is return three times that to my LPs. So if I got in $50 million, I'd like to, over a long period of time, return $150 million back to them. And what that would mean would be that's $100 million in profit. Started out with 50 plus $100 million in profit, ends up with 150. As a VC, you take 20% of that, of those profits. The VC firm, the GPs, get 20% of the profits. So that's where really the money is made. It's a performance incentive. The 2% keeps the lights on. The 20% is the performance fee, which is where like the bulk of the financial return is made, what we're going after. Raise your hand if you have any questions about that. Secondly, constrained by 10-year life. So what that means is within this, I said that we have to return that $150 million. In a $50 million fund, we're aiming to return $150 million. We're aiming to do that in a 10-year life cycle. So the fund itself literally is in the existing creation documents, lives for 10 years. That means that all of our capital has to be both deployed and returned back to our investors within a 10-year time frame. Many.
I've heard a 3x return is really good, right? You just did
the 3x. Yes.
The 3x is really good, and that's before or after the 20%.
So thank you. So 3x return, is that before or after the 20%? So 3x is typically net of fees. So I definitely oversimplified the math in what I just said. So that means that after all of the fees are taken out, both the 2% and the 20% over all this time period, I want 150 to actually go back into the pockets of my LPs. And so the reason why VCs target 3x, that's three times the initial investment, is because historically that would put you in the top quartile of returns. The median return is substantially less than that. But if I'm targeting 3x, I'm modeling, this is what I expect, this is what I hope. Of course, as any investor, you don't promise anything to the people who you're managing their money for, but that just helps frame the expectations of where we're targeting. So actually, net of fees, in order to generate 3x, you actually have to generate more than $150 million because a whole lot of that is coming out as fees. So it would probably be close to I got $50 million in after a bunch of fees. I probably invested closer to $45 million, and then I need to turn that $45 million into something closer to like $170 million. So again, that's how it's driven. It's also, go ahead.
So how do you deal with the liquidity issue then at the end of that 10 years?
Yes. So certain companies, particularly in this market, are going a lot longer, staying private a lot longer. You can file for an extension to basically continue to manage beyond that 10 years. So for example, if I had Uber, if I invested in year four out of my fund in Uber, and Uber took almost a decade to go public, if in year six it's still in the portfolio and I invested at a $10 million valuation and now it's a $1 billion company, you're probably not mad at me that it's sitting in the portfolio. But eventually you do want a liquidity event. So I talk to my investors, my LPs, and say, hey, we'd like to file an extension. Is everybody on board with this? And if you have Uber in your portfolio, the answer is yes. Like, we're returning way more than probably 3x your investment, your overall investment. The other thing I wanted to say was it's because it is illiquid, because you're literally asking someone to basically lock up this capital for a very extended period of time, the expectations are that you'll outperform the public market. So like the stock market, S&P, I think is annualized is somewhere around 11-12%, taking the last decade into consideration. If you were to 3x something over a venture fund over a 10-year period, that's in the ballpark of like the low 20% annualized, 20-25%, depending on how you deploy the capital. So this is far outperforming. The expectations are to far outperform the stock market, and you need to compensate your LPs for that risk or for that holding of during that entire time. So that's why people, part of the reason why people think of it as a risky asset class, if you will. So what does that mean for how we actually invest, this 2 and 20 and everything else? The VC rule of thumb that I have up here is VCs ask themselves whenever they're deploying any capital, will this investment return my fund? Meaning, so like if I make an investment in your company and I buy 10% today, will it, and if I have a $50 million fund, will that investment turn into $50 million in and of itself? And I ask that with every single investment that I make. And one of the challenges behind that is obviously I know that not all of them are going to do that. In fact, most won't do that. But what I do need is to make an investment that's going to grow and be big enough to do that. So if I'm investing in your company, let's just say I'm investing $2.5 million into your company, and I get 10% for it, in order for, and then let's take dilution out of the equation for a second. That means that implied in that, if I own 10% of your company, in order to get $50 million back, that means you have to sell your company or exit at a $500 million valuation in order for me to sort of realize the type of exit that I was looking for. This is why you'll often hear VCs say things like, "Oh, that opportunity isn't big enough." Or we want the market to be bigger. We want this to be a really, really big idea. It's because in order to, they think about things in terms of, in order to return the fund, we need this to have room to grow into a massive company. A lot of times we get approached by entrepreneurs who think maybe it's not going to be $100 million company, but it's going to be a good investment. Like, we have a low risk of failing, and we have a high risk of returning 2 or 3 times your money, and they feel like that should be an attractive opportunity to VCs. In fact, it's not, because that's not how we're structured. We, in order to pay for the losses in the fund, we expect that there be massive outcomes on the side of the winners. So the question is, if there's a company that has, or he identified a trend that there's a lot of IP, or there's some companies that had great IP but poor execution, and so there was some asset there that was valuable, I think you implied that the VCs take the IP and then monetize it elsewhere. The last part I would challenge you on. VCs are not operating companies, nor are they, we usually don't hold majority ownership. We usually hold minority ownership in companies, and thus, the part that I would agree with you with is that if a company does not have the growth trajectory that's expected by VCs, and sometimes that's more pressure or a direction that the entrepreneur or the owner of the IP doesn't necessarily want to go, then there would be pressure from the VCs to either exit the business, meaning sell the business or sell the IP, or there'll be pressure to find out a new approach or a new way that you're going to grow and scale this opportunity to where it will be something that returns the fund size. The other thing that I want, that is implied in this, is bigger funds require bigger exits. If I'm expecting to return a $18 million fund, like 10110's first fund was, and if I owned, let's say, 10% of your company, then you could do that at a $180 million valuation. If I have a $100 million fund and I own 10% of your company, then we need a $1 billion valuation to exit in order to realize that. So either bigger funds must either own more of your company, or they must have bigger exit expectations. So it's not the same to take $500,000 from, say, a 10-1-10 versus taking $500,000 from a much larger fund. That's a great question. Is there a limit to the number of companies you invest in, and how much do you reserve for basically follow-on capital? So usually when funds start out, they have an idea of how many companies they want to invest in, and that's based on their strategy. Some strategies are, we take a more concentrated approach, so we want to invest in 20 companies. We want to have higher ownership percentages. We want to be more hands-on. And that's a fine strategy. A lot of people work out that way. And then a lot of people disagree and say, my goal is to make sure that I'm in the next Airbnb or Uber, so I'm going to invest in as many companies as I possibly can. So it might be 50, 60 companies in the portfolio. Obviously, I won't be able to spend as much dedicated time to each one, but my idea is that if I do get Uber, then it doesn't matter. All the rest of this doesn't matter. And both approaches have worked historically to produce above average returns. The question of follow-on capital is another great question. So a lot of times people do start with usually you reserve as a venture fund, you reserve a special amount of capital to then go on to deploy into that company, if you will. So if my initial investment was $500,000, I might have another $500,000 earmarked for that company. That could be used for if the company's running into some challenges and it needs a bridge and I'm going to be there to support it. It could also be if the company's doing exceptionally well, raises additional capital, and I want to deploy more capital into that company. So different. You can ask venture funds what their ratio is when you're sitting and pitching them. Say, like, how much do you reserve for follow-on? What's your typical investment size? How much do you reserve for follow-on? That's a very fair question that we could ask pretty frequently. So that's all I have about like the structure of venture firms, and I spend a lot of time on that, but I think that helps figure out how we evaluate companies. So there's three main components of how we evaluate companies or think through companies. The first is the market, second is the product, and third is the team. And I'll start off by saying that the team, in my view, and probably a lot of other investors, is far and away the most important. But I'm going to go in this order of what I just said. So market. So we look at the macro forces on the addressable market. So like what's happening in your industry or in the company that you're facing that makes this a very interesting opportunity now, like today. Like why couldn't this company have been built 5 years ago? I keep going back to the example of Uber. Uber could not have been built 5 years prior because there was no location-based mobile device in every single person's pocket at that time. And so this was a very, very timely thing that happened that they took advantage of. What are the macro forces? What is happening either in the landscape? What regulatory changes? What is making it so that now is the time for your company to exist? Competitive landscape. Don't ever think you don't have any competitors, because what that basically means to me, or what I hear when I hear people say that, is that there's no money being spent in this area. So like even if it's not a direct competitor, think of your competitive landscape from the standpoint of who are you taking dollars away from? Because new dollars don't just exist out of nowhere. They're coming from someone else. And it might be a direct competitor. And then that brings me to the next point, which is what's your key insight? How are you thinking about this that's fundamentally different than your competitors or other people in the market that are approaching this? Again, pop up with any questions if you have them. Next, I'll talk about product. Product is we want to know about the progress you've made to date and your forward-looking roadmap. So, like, what are you thinking about? Given that we have a very limited time to build a very large company, that means it's a very high growth opportunity we're looking for. And one of the things we look at is sort of your pace. If you've been working on the same idea for 6 years and you're about to launch next month, I'm skeptical that you're actually going to launch next month, quite frankly. And we see that a lot. But I think if you say, like, you know, we've been working on this a year and a half, 2 years, we left our jobs a year and a half ago, we launched 6 months after that, we got our first big contract 3 months after that, and then today we're, you know, we have four more contracts we're about to close or whatever, then I think that that's more believable, and you understand the trajectory, you understand that this might be able to potentially get on that high growth thing. What are the meaningful milestones? I think I want you to think about milestones in terms of you define them for the investor. Do not have the investor define them for you. Yes, you should understand the market and how people are measuring things, but I'll give two examples of things that have happened. So I think if you think back to 2003, 2004, when everybody was talking about impressions or page views for different websites, and that's how you measured a media company. A little company called Facebook came along and got everybody to start thinking in terms of like active users, daily active users, weekly active users. They basically catalyzed the idea that we're different, and this is a more meaningful metric for you to consider our progress or our success or our unique value proposition. That they're an example of a company that did that exceptionally well and have every social media company measured by, and most media companies at this point measured by that level. A company that's done it poorly, on the other hand, I think personally, is Twitter. Because Twitter, by everybody in here, has either seen tweets or is on Twitter or active or knows that Twitter affects media broadly. But I don't think that they've ever been able to capture the value because they've always been measured by Facebook's metrics. And they've never been able to correctly identify what they should be measured by, which appropriately shows the value that they bring to the world, and which is massive. So revenue and cost structure, we just want to make sure that you're going in the right direction. I think that over the last decade, you've seen a lot of companies that focus on growth, and we'll figure out a business model later. Things change very quickly if the economy changes. And it's hard to believe that what's happened over the last 10 years, that model worked very well, will work over the next 10 years. So I think understanding exactly how the business is formed will be especially useful. How am I doing on time? Because I know I'm late.
Since people are asking questions during,
yeah,
I have about 8 more minutes.
Okay.
And then we'll just wrap up completely.
Got it. Perfect. Okay. So I'm gonna go very quickly then. So team, relevant experience or demonstrated ability. Relevant experience is great. I don't need you to have been an expert in the industry that you're working in, but I do want to know that everybody who knows you thinks of you as a high performer. That there's something exceptional. Like when we look into who you are, what drives you, that I have reason to believe that you'll be successful in this. Attract and retain talent. We want to make sure that like the most successful founders are like gravity in terms of really talented people wanting to work with them or knowing about them, and they can convince people to come on and basically leave their high paying job to take a lower salary because they believe in a vision. History of collaboration. Founder breakups are often some of the most critical things that lead to the downfall of startups. So we want to make sure that you're working with somebody who you know or who you've worked with and can sort of build something with. And then full-time commitment. A lot of people come to us with ideas of like, all right, well, once I get funded, I'm going to go and do this. I recognize that not everybody's in a financial situation that like you could just leave your job for 6 months or whatnot. But the reality is, I think in order to be taken seriously by investors, you have to figure out how to be all in it. Yep. Please. Question. So the question is, like, obviously the demographics of venture capital or who gets funded are skewed toward a very specific demographic, or it's not even demographic, profile of person. And the question is, like, how do you both incorporate diversity without throwing off a bunch of other red flags for people or concerns? I have an answer that I deeply believe that may not be the most ideal answer as a founder, but I deeply believe it. I think the reality is, with the changing venture landscape, you've got to talk to people that recognize the value of who you are and value of your unique perspective. I think that when all venture capitalists come from that background, it's very easy for them to identify people. And very easy for them to understand whether this person is a high performer or something like that. I think that you need venture investors. That's an example that I gave on a panel that I was on with many. 10-1-10, I spend a lot of time working and thinking about diversity and how to incorporate it into the practice, how to support women investors and things like that. And I'm pretty public about it as well. And so I do a lot of things around women investors, but when many came to 10-1-10, the number of deals that we saw with women-led founders quadrupled, like overnight. And when you have somebody that you can identify with, that you can talk to, and things like that, I would strongly encourage you to not spend a lot of time with people that don't see the value of your team. Make the team that you want and with the values that you value, and then find investors that believe in that. Because otherwise, it's going to be extremely painful process when your priorities aren't aligned with that person, and you're going to be working with them for a very long time. I want to wrap this up with identifying investors. Basically, make sure you do find people that are investing at your stage and your fit. Question. Go ahead. Sure. I'll give an example. Like, there are different values and different experiences of investors. And if you're working with somebody, particularly somebody who might be leading your round or taking a board seat, or somebody who you're meeting with on a regular basis and is helping you shape how you think about your business, it's going to make a huge difference. I mean, and there's different things that different people bring to the table. I, most of my career, I've been on the investing side. I work, 10-1-10 consists of an entire fund of people that are like through and through operators. David Waxman, Minnie Ingersoll, like have seen so many things that I as an investor could not bring to the table. I think I bring other things to the table, but like if you sit and talk to David or Minnie about like how you how you grow a business or what it looks like for you to when you start growing to a point where you don't recognize the people that even work for you anymore, like how to even deal with that, like what do you do? I couldn't answer that question with a personal anecdote. Minnie knows that like the back of her hand. So I think it comes with. This is why you want to spend a lot of time in advance of taking somebody's capital, particularly if they're going to be a significant, like probably leading your round. The other folks, probably less so. Like you said, a check is a check. And if I don't have to talk to you outside of like a monthly update, then yeah, it doesn't matter. But for the people that are going to be in your ear, you want to make sure that they're people that you have values aligned with. I guess probably time for one more question. All right. The question was about the thesis of the new fund that I'm a part of. So OPV, what we do, and I'll just go to this. So OPV, what we do is we focus specifically on tools and platforms that support the development of small business. We look at that in three different categories. The first is tools or platforms that enable the creation of new small businesses. So that would be like, let's see, in LA, that would be like a WeCare or a Service Titan that supports new businesses and sort of surrounds them with all the software that they need that's specific to their industry. The second category is tools that support a specific function. So think in terms of like HR with Gusto or Xero with accounting or Stripe or Square with payments. And then the third category is folks that are in our network that have basically been bootstrapping to date, and nobody's ever really talked to them about what it looks like to scale up their business or their operations. Usually they have products or things in market and that are loved locally by people, but never really thought about things from a venture standpoint, and we help them scale it up. So we invest in pre-seed and seed rounds. And so, well, with that, this is my email address. Obviously, you could, anybody here, please, if you email me, reference that you were here so I could prioritize it and recognize it. And would love to be in touch with everybody. Thank you all for having me. I really appreciate it. Great deal.
Awesome. If you can stay up here, actually. Thank you so much, Austin. That was amazing. I love Dan's question, and I love that when you added Minnie, it just created a further ripple of diversity in who you're working with. So that's amazing. Next week, I am your speaker. I'm looking forward to speaking with you. Yes. Come learn about uncrossing your wires to power your connections and create innovation. So with that, have a wonderful weekend, and we'll look forward to seeing you next week.